Welcome to Talaterra, a podcast about freelance educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. Who are these educators? What do they do? Join me, and let's find out together. This is your host, Tanya Marion. Today, my guest is Marijke Hecht. Marijke is a doctoral candidate in learning sciences and policy at the University of Pittsburgh. Her research is focused on how people learn out of school, particularly how they learn in nature. I shared her paper, Becoming a Naturalist, over the summer. See episode 21. What has Marijke learned about how a naturalist's identity develops? How can guest educators contribute to an outdoor program? What drives learning ecosystems in the informal sector? What should be driving them instead? Let's find out. Your research addresses learning pathways, specifically the experiences that lead someone to becoming a naturalist or that support that interest. What was your pathway to becoming a naturalist?
What a great question. I think like the folks that I interviewed in the article, Becoming a Naturalist, my pathway was varied. I personally did not come into my love of the non-human natural world until I was a little bit older. I do have some memories of outdoor play. My mom had a community garden plot, which was an important space that I hung out in. But I hadn't really done anything that you would think of as kind of more traditional nature things like camping or hiking or even learning how to ride a bicycle until I was 18 or 19 years old. Can I tell a little story? So I went to college in I grew up right in the heart of New York City, very, very urban. And then I went to college in a very rural community in Western Massachusetts. And that very first semester, my first year in this completely different kind of environment in every possible way, I was walking across the quad. It was kind of a traditional looking campus, and there was a quad. And I was walking on the grassy area, and I had this realization that the ground was hard beneath my feet, that it had frozen. And it was the first time in my life that I ever considered that the ground freezes, because I had been walking all those years on concrete. And from there, I just got more and more captivated with these things that I would notice about the natural world, the non-human natural world that had eluded me before. And so I continued studying science education. I ended up getting a master's in botany. I taught science in middle and high school. And then for about 15 years, I did informal environmental education and stewardship here in Pittsburgh, where I live now, which is a wonderful city with all the excellence of cities, but also all the many problems of cities. So it's a very interesting place to think about how the environment functions, both in terms of human and non-human natural communities.
When did you realize nature was important to you?
I think that story that I just told of walking across the quad was, you know, one of those moments. Just going back to the article, one of the things that I learned in the article that was also true for me as you're asking me this question is that there was no single moment. You know, these things they emerge over time, and they kind of different experiences intersect. And so I think for me, it was kind of a slow awakening. When I taught middle and high school in New York City, I went back home after college and taught public school. And I had the experience of having young people ask me questions about the names of trees. I taught science, and so they thought I knew everything about science, you know. And I can remember in particular one young man asking me the names of the trees, and I didn't know the names of the trees. And so I started looking them up. I think that was the first field guide that I got. I was 25, so I was not young. I mean, I'm young compared to what I am now, but I wasn't like I was a child growing up knowing the difference between a maple and an oak. And I was an adult already. And I think the first field guide I got was that Peterson's Guide to Eastern Trees. I still have it, I'm sure, on my shelf. And I just started trying to figure out what the street trees were in New York City. And from there, I got more and more captivated with trying to identify plants I like to joke, as many botanists do, that plants are wonderful because they can't fly away. You can just sit there and key them out, mm-hmm. and you can go back to the same place. If you don't get it the first time, you can go back and look at it in a different season. So they're a really nice place to begin your kind of naturalist endeavors and then progress onto other kinds of taxa.
How did you come to study what you study now?
So I mentioned that I studied botany for my master's. Mm-hmm. And then I came to Pittsburgh after that and began working in the urban environmental community here, doing work in watersheds. I worked on a big stream restoration project in one of our large parks. And I ended up as the director of education for a nonprofit organization called the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. And I fell into that because I have come to believe and firmly believe that education is really at the heart of making environmental improvements, whether it's building people's interest, building people's understanding, building their compassion. All of those things can come from educational experiences, which is how I ended up in this job at the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy as the director of education. And I was able to work with an amazing team of educators. We ran programs, they still do, of, you know, with people of all ages using urban parks as classrooms. And during those years, I was there for 7 years, I realized, wow, I'm doing all this education. I have no training in education. I don't know any theory about education. And when you're doing programs the way that I was, you're moving very quickly all the time. You're always trying to invent new programs and, you know, make sure that you're serving kids and families and adults as best you can. You don't have a lot of time for reflection. And so I thought that the opportunity to go back to school and get a PhD in learning sciences would give me that opportunity to really think more deeply and reflectively about what is it that makes good education, good environmental education? How can it be most impactful? How do we create naturalists of the future?
What have you learned so far about how a naturalist's identity develops?
So I want to talk about two projects that I'm working on from my dissertation that I think both relate to how a naturalist identity develops. The first is the paper that you saw, the Becoming a Naturalist paper, where I was able to interview people and learn from the benefit of their retrospection, right? They're looking back, they're recollecting their life experience. And what we saw from those interviews was a couple of things. One is there is no one pathway. And I think often educational policy is looking for ideals that we can reproduce. But what we see in people's actual lived experiences is that there's many pathways that can potentially positively lead to this outcome that we are looking for in this case of a naturalist identity. But there were some strong common themes. So the vast majority of people did have independent outdoor time. And I stress the word independent because you can have all kinds of very structured outdoor experiences. But people of all ages, which runs counter, I think, a little bit to some of the dominant narrative we hear in the media now, that like kids now aren't playing outside. But even the youngest interviewees who are in their early 20s talked fairly extensively about independent outdoor time. Some of that was literally just sitting in front of their house, like digging with an old Barbie doll in the dirt. It wasn't always some big wilderness. In fact, it often wasn't. So that was really important. The other thing that I really took away was the ways that school and out of school intersect, and that out of school experiences often provide sparks for young people. They reveal something to them. In this case, with these interviewees, many of them had these moments in a scouting program, a museum experience, where they saw this little bit of nature and wanted to learn more. But that school also anchors that and gives a depth of understanding. And I guess it doesn't have to be that way. So one of the questions that we ended with at the end of that paper and that I've been talking about with other out-of-school practitioners is, how could out-of-school programs maybe do a more thorough job of helping people develop long-term individual interest, especially in areas that are not attended to in schools enough, like environmental education. We don't see a lot of opportunity for environmental education in schools. And so if out-of-school places are only sparking the interest but never giving people a chance to deepen it, it's maybe a missed opportunity. And then the last thing I'll say about that is we learned a lot about the very, very important role of mentors. Some of them were family, but some of the mentors were non-familial folks, teachers, people that worked in a museum that saw a young person's interest and helped move them to the next opportunity. And people were very passionate about the way that these mentors helped them. And sometimes these were not folks who had long-term relationships with the young people. And that was important for, I think, us to think about, again, when we go back to current programs. We often think of a mentor as someone who like knows you for years and years and years. But these people were looking back on their lives and they were able to identify folks that they maybe only knew for 2, 3, 4 months in a program, but they had a very important impact on them. So we kind of took all of those things. And another paper that I'm currently working on is looking in real time now at a program that is working with teens to try to understand how in real time are these teens developing their naturalist identity? What is the role of the educators? What is the role of guest experts that came into this program? This is a paid summer internship that I studied. So how do these guest experts who are practicing scientists inform kids' identity development? And also, how does the non-human nature play a direct role in forming their naturalist affinity? How does a moth landing on your hair connect you to the natural world in a different kind of way, this non-human natural world? Or how does learning to overcome a fear of spiders by letting one sit on your hand for the very first time when you're 16 years old, how does that change the way you see yourself in terms of how you relate to non-human nature, some of which can be a little scary? So that's what I'm looking at now.
And when you gather information from these teens, is it through journaling? Is it through conversation? All of the above?
Yeah, this was such a fun project. So the data collection part of this project, well, it was fun because I got to be outside with the teens. I partnered with a parks organization and they have a paid summer internship, which is a very unique and wonderful experience. The young people are getting a stipend. They get some outdoor gear like boots and rain jackets and t-shirts to wear. So they get transportation passes. So they're trying to overcome some of the potential barriers to participation. They spend 5 weeks in this paid summer internship. So I spent the summer with them. The data includes what's called participant observations. So I was both a participant in the program. I led some activities. And then I was observing constantly and just taking notes, very ethnographic style notes in my field journal and also on the computer when we were indoors. I interviewed all of the young people individually. We also had three group kind of facilitated conversations that all of these were recorded. I interviewed all of the educators. And then there were artifacts like a journal, which you mentioned. So the young people were given field journals. Part of what the program tries to do is really ground everything in very real world experiences. So the field journals are the Write in the Rain, if you've ever used the Write in the Rain field journals, really giving them the tools that real ecologists use in the field. So they had those. So their recordings in those journals become data. We did some photo activities that became data. So all kinds of things like that. And I'm working on the cases right now.
Now, you mentioned that that the summer program also had guest experts. Teens' interaction with these guests, were they for only an hour, for a day, half a day, or how did that work?
Yeah, this is one of the more surprising findings for me. I underestimated the impact of these experts. So it was very important for the educators to present the youth with a picture of what a future career path might be. The educators really saw themselves as brokers for the young people in kind of moving along that pathway that we were talking about earlier. So they wanted to bring these experts in. What I saw was tremendous attention on the experts when they were there. Sometimes it was as short as an hour. All of the guest experts were interacting with the youth very specifically around their area of expertise. Probably the longest engagement we had was with an ecologist who does a lot of work with moths. We did probably a 3-hour activity at night where he set up a trap so we could see the moths coming in at night. And then he also set up an overnight trap and stayed with us. And the next morning we spent another couple of hours with him. So that was a fairly extended period. There was another person who spent that much time with us over 2 sessions on data visualization. We had horticulturalists come in, a herpetologist came in. So really like a number of different folks, someone who did very applied restoration ecology came in, who does more like design work. And what I noticed, and I'm just working on writing the cases up now, and this really comes through when you look at kind of the whole corpus of the data, the kids are deeply, deeply engaged when these experts are there in a way that as much as they love the educators that were there every day, the attention, the focused questioning that the youth have, the probing about asking these experts about their own pathways was very noticeable. And I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier. A mentor doesn't have to be someone you know for years and years. Some of these guest experts were able to give fleeting kinds of advice by explaining their pathway, by suggesting that the young person go try a different program that they knew about. Just some small moves like that, that I would predict in 10 or 15 or 20 years, if I were to go back and interview these young people, they will remember those experiences. You could kind of see it happening in real time.
And this interaction developed organically, or did you have an orientation for the visiting, for the guests, and say, you know, this is what we're doing?
That is a great question. And I give a tremendous amount of credit to the lead educators of the program. There were 2 educators, one of whom had been running the program since its inception, which is about 6 years ago. And the other of whom, really, just really neat, she had been a high schooler who was in the program. And now, as a 21-year-old, was teaching in the program. So that was a really cool thing. And one of the things that they did was they were very explicit about their expectations for the youth, but also for the guest educators. So another artifact that I have are the email exchanges where they email the guest educators to confirm their participation. And they asked them very specifically to think in advance about their pathway so that they could articulate what was their educational pathway, what were different jobs that they have. They also asked them to all really kind of ground their work in real life examples. So they prepped the guest educators to think in advance about the kinds of things that they hoped they would say to the kids in their introductions. And I think because of that, they didn't need to do a lot of the regular educators didn't need to do a lot of work once these guests had come in. They'd already primed them. Mm-hmm. And you could see they all started out with, yeah, here's how I got here. And the kids would ask more questions. You know, what kind of school did you go to? How did you get to that? What other jobs have you had? How much time do you spend outside in your job? Because, I mean, probably like you and me, it's wonderful to be outside. So how much do they really, as adults in these environmental careers, truly get to be outside was a question that was asked repeatedly. And I think the guests were very comfortable because they had had some time to think about these things in advance.
Mm-hmm. How many guests did the youth have a chance to interact with over that 5-week period?
Something on the order of 6. It was about once a week someone would come in, maybe a little bit more than once a week, and a nice variety of types of environmental careers, so that they could meet a horticulturalist that's working more in a cultural landscape and see how that would be very different from, say, being an ecologist working on large conservation projects, and then also how that might be very different from, say, the woman who came in to do data visualization and really teach them about GIS. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of a suite of things that they could see as possible futures.
the element of your study that involves the guest educators piqued my interest because my audience is comprised of freelance environmental educators, and they work throughout their community in all sorts of different venues. And when I read your paper and shared it over the summer, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about is, well, how can the freelance educators contribute to the learning ecology and the pathways? Their time with their visitors is very limited. It got me thinking, how can they contribute to long-term learning? Because these are all free choice learning environments, right? Choice and control are with the visitors. People can interact with the environmental educator or not. I was wondering, what role freelance educators can play in the overall learning ecology when it comes to learning outside of the classroom, seeing as they work in so many different settings? I was wondering if you have a feel for what they might be able to do.
I have a couple of thoughts. Mm-hmm. One is the guest educators that were the most transparent. In other words, gave not only a big volume of information about their lives, but a really authentic presentation of their pathway, I would say were the most successful at connecting with the teens. And, you know, as you well know, and anyone who works with people, but especially young people and especially teenagers, I would say, they can sniff out authenticity or lack thereof very quickly. So coming in, kind of being your best authentic self right from the beginning was very potent in terms of the young people's response to the guest educators. The other thing that they were all able to do, and again, this was very much structured by the regular educators, but any educator could do this on their own, is that whatever they brought in wasn't, whatever activity they were doing was grounded in something real. Like, for example, we had the opportunity to watch a bird banding for about an hour and a half. They were really doing the bird banding. They were really collecting the data. It was not a demonstration. I mean, they were demonstrating the activity to us, but they were typing the data into a database at that moment. And I think that realness was very important. The same, like I mentioned with the moth, the guy who came in and did moths, he kept track of every species. He uploaded it all onto iNaturalist. So they were able to see that this is actual science happening. It's not pretend. And I think when people come in, even if it's fleeting, if the folks that they're engaging with can see that it's real and meaningful, it gives them a window into what they maybe could do in the future for themselves. I also think that building relationships over time between the guests and wherever you're visiting is really helpful. Several of the guest educators had done their activity before with the program, and they were familiar with the program. So even though they're maybe only interacting for an hour or two each summer, they still have the summer before to recollect and build on. So long-term relationship building between guest educators and programs, I think, is really helpful all around.
Your research is also focused on research practice partnerships. What makes the best types of partnerships? One of my objectives with my project is to bring attention to the work that independent educators do in their communities and to show the depth and the breadth and the knowledge of the people who work in this capacity, and also to encourage organizations and people and municipalities and others to consider the independent educators as community partners. So instead of automatically going to a museum or going to a science center or something like that, to consider the other people in the community who are working in all sorts of different ways. And so community building and partnerships is a big interest of mine, and how these independent educators can develop the partnerships. You know, what should they do? And what could they do to encourage these larger organizations to consider them as partners? You know, what are they looking for when they're looking for community partners? Mm. What have you observe over the time that you've been working within that world?
First, that's such a great position that you're starting from. I really appreciate your goal to kind of shine a light on the values that these independent educators can bring. I think one of the things that I really liked about the Becoming a Naturalist paper, those interviews, is that some of the folks were not quote unquote professional scientists. They are incredible naturalists. There's so much knowledge that lives within people, and it behooves all of us to kind of let that out. So thank you for that. As far as partnerships, research practice partnerships are a very specific kind of partnership. And one of the things about them is that, you know, researchers have often kind of come into communities and studied them in a very uneven type of power play. And so the idea of a research practice partnership is to have a more equitable relationship between researchers and practitioners. That aspect of a research practice partnership, I think, relates to your question about how independent educators might partner with large organizations. Because again, you have a power imbalance between a well-funded institution and an independent contractor. So the first thing you need to have is like a genuine desire for partnership on both sides. And then even when there's a genuine desire for partnership on both sides, the best partnerships that I've been involved in, and I've done, I think the reason I love research practice partnerships is my entire career has been based on partnerships. Every successful thing I have ever been involved in has relied on a partnership of some kind, sometimes multiple partners. So I really value partnerships, but I also see how difficult they are. And so some of the things that I think have contributed to the best partnerships I've been involved in are one, authentic desire to partner, which means being willing to be clear about what your needs and goals are, recognize the other partner's needs and goals, and acknowledge that they sometimes will intersect in productive ways. That's what you want to concentrate on. And sometimes they're going to diverge. That's also okay. You can't make everything work. You just need to find those points of intersection. And so for the independent educator, they have a mission, perhaps their own personal mission, to say, you know, reach teens or to lead bird walks or whatever that thing may be that they really like to do. But also, like, what do they need to get out of it, and how can they ask for that clearly from the larger institution so that it really can be equitable and they can be clear about where their goals are and then how that might intersect, I think is important. I also just think partnerships take so much time. And so we need to give them that time for them to flourish. When we try to rush, partnerships are all about relationships. Relationships don't happen quickly. You know, relationships require a lot of ongoing communication, interaction. You need to have some successful experiences together to feel like you can do something. You need to build trust over time. So how could an independent educator make the time for that? You know, an obvious challenge is like, you need to make money. And so you need to convince that larger institution that they hopefully would invest in you, not just one-off, right? Are they going to invest in you? Can I be your partner for a year or 2 years? You know, bring me back for your next season. And here's the value that you'll get from me because I know your institution, I know your programs, I know your audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you observed or do you know of many partnerships that involve an independent individual, independent educator, and an institution or an organization of some kind? Or are they mostly organization type partnerships?
At the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy, where I worked and also did this teen study, they have a lot of independent educators that they work with on an annual basis, primarily for their Earth Day activities. And years ago, they asked people to volunteer to lead walks. And then we made a choice that was not fair. And so now everybody gets paid. And some of the people are coming from another institution. And so they say, we don't need the money because I'm already getting paid. But many of the people who are leading the mushroom walks and the spider walks and all of these things are independent educators, exactly the people that you are hoping to reach. And so they get paid for their time. So that's a really nice example, I think, of a fairly large institution that has a lot of internal capacity, has a lot of educators on staff, but has recognized there's all these community members out there that have their specialty, that love to share that with the community. And here's a simple, in the scheme of things, a relatively low-cost way for us to engage them. They're not on staff. They're not, yeah. There's no benefits, but they get paid for their time. The other thing is actually a different kind of example, not in environmental education, but another project that I'm working on is looking at the creative learning community here in Pittsburgh, the ecosystem, the creative learning ecosystem. And much of the creative learning ecosystem is fed by teaching artists who are effectively what you're describing in the environmental education field. They're working artists, they are independent contractors, and they tend to work for one or two or three or four different institutions doing educational programs as a way to support their artistry. And I think that's pretty typical of teaching artists. So it might be something interesting to think about is like, how does a creative learning community where there's a large number of teaching artists that are getting employed regularly by institutions, how might that be a model for environmental educators who are their own kind of practicing specialists, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe they're photographers or maybe they're environmental designers or maybe they're something else as well, but they also bring this educational sensibility to their work.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Building partnerships takes time and trust, as you've mentioned. What signals do you think these organizations look for? And you, as a former director at the Conservancy, an education director, what signals do you look for? What signs do you look for from an independent professional and their body of work, their personality, who you heard, how you heard about, how you learned about them? What sign makes you think, okay, I will follow up with you? And what do you think is that first tiny little step to trust building? What do you think that is?
I'm going to take the first part first about the sign. So one thing that's really important in an independent educator is they need to be really knowledgeable about something, right? Mm-hmm. About the moths, about the spiders, about trees. And they need to be really good communicators. Often, people who really get into non-human nature, I don't want to say often, but sometimes those people are not really people, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And part of the reason why they become so drawn to the non-human natural world is because they're not necessarily the most effective communicators. So I would say one sign is I want to see someone who either is a strong communicator out of the gate or is really committed to learning that skill. And you don't have to be flashy, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes, we think of the educator as like a performer. And certainly many good educators are very,
Animated.
Animated. But just to go back to the gentleman who does the moths, he's a fairly shy person. I would guess he describes himself as an introvert. He is extremely, extremely skillful with like every taxa. I mean, he's one of the best naturalists I've ever been around. Like anything, you point to it, he knows what it is. But he's managed to find a way to use his quiet and intense love for these things and communicate that. So I don't think you have to be flashy, but I do think you need to find a way to use your own communication style to the best of its ability. And some of that is going back to, I feel like I've said the word authentic a million times, but it's just such an important thing. Some of that is just really being authentically passionate about it, showing why you love it, why you think these little brown moths are actually gorgeous when you look at them up close, and just getting excited, even if it's in a quiet way. So that's something that I look for, is someone who has a sense of how to communicate what matters to them.
You are working on your dissertation.
Yes.
And you will be finished in spring.
March 18th is my date. March 18th is my defense date.
Goodness, that's getting close.
That's very close.
And the title of your thesis, of your dissertation, sorry, does it have one?
It does. And will you give me a minute?
Sure.
Because I should know it off the top of my head. I'm so incredibly deep in the weeds that it gets a little fuzzy, and I want to give you the actual title. So give me 1 minute. The title of my dissertation is Citywide Learning Ecosystems: How Relational Processes Between People and Place Support Learning Across Scale.
The department you're working in, now I need to look this up. I didn't get the up close. The
That's okay. Mm-hmm. The lab that I work in. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I am in a program called Learning Sciences and Policy. My advisor runs a lab called the University of Pittsburgh Center for Learning in Out-of-School Environments. And we do research around natural areas, museums, some arts-based, a lot science-based, natural history-based, but all kind of thinking about these informal spaces, which are, you know, places where people have, I think you said earlier, they have the control, right? They're deciding mm-hmm. to enter the museum or to take the program. So those are the kinds of spaces that we look at in the lab that I work in.
Yeah. And the public policy aspect of this work, you know, I have a feeling that I have never been able to articulate yet about this project that I'm doing and how it might relate to the public policy world, but I haven't been able to articulate it myself. And so I was wondering, what type of public policy do you advocate and using your work as an example?
Yeah, so the paper that I mentioned that looks at learning ecosystems specifically brings up funders, the funding community. In the informal sector, we are not dependent on, nor are we governed by, governmental policy the way that the K-12 school sector is, or even higher education is. There's very clear policies that come from government. But when we think about informal learning in nature centers and museums and parks, who's deciding the policies? Well, it is funders primarily. It is philanthropic centers. So how do they make decisions about what part of a learning ecosystem they might fund? Where will they focus their energies? Those are important policies. And one of the things that I argue in that paper is that I think we make a mistake when we focus all of our energies on individual youth or individual programs. We would do better drawing on the biological ecosystem as a conceptual framework. I think we would do better to see individual youth, for example, as indicator species. When we look at an indicator species, they help us understand something about the health of the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. But we don't design ecosystems to serve indicator species. When we're doing adaptive management of ecosystems in a very active way, we would be more likely to use a keystone species that's driving energy flows through a system. Like a wolf in Yellowstone, right? That's probably the most famous example of a keystone, but it doesn't have to be a top predator. So what's the keystone species in a learning ecosystem? Well, I think it's the educators. We need to invest in educators. And that is what we're trying to do here in Pittsburgh, is think about how funders could really focus their energies on the educators. And by virtue of doing that, they're likely to really support the youth indirectly. The way that when you focus on a keystone, the indicator species is healthier, right? But that's not your design intent. So that's the kind of thing that article looks at. And I think that is a policy choice that we can make, is to invest more in educators, specifically out-of-school educators, that do not receive the pay, professional development, credibility that they deserve.
What's next for you?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out. I hope that what is next for me includes working closely with educators and young people, particularly teens. It's where I derive the most pleasure. I hope that what comes next for me, I know that what comes next for me will continue to include as much engagement with the non-human natural world as possible, because it is what makes me feel good. So from a selfish perspective, I have to be out there. I have to be looking and listening. I want there to be some teaching and writing and reading in there. And I think those things can come from a lot of different kinds of jobs. So I don't know exactly what the job will be, but I hope it will include those aspects.
To learn more about Marijke, see the show notes for this episode. Talaterra is a podcast for and about independent educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and colleagues. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Tanya Marion.